Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with actresses Stacey Ross and Martha Brigham, who star as controversial 1930s German filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl in the play Leni at the Aurora Theater. Hanneke van Proost, co-director of San Francisco-based early music ensemble Voices of Music, shares details about the 10th anniversary of the ensemble and this weekend's concerts. Also, a conversation with actress Aisha Jordan, who plays the girl in Eclipsed, the story of five extraordinary women currently at the newly renovated Curran Theater in San Francisco. Plus, regular contributor and critic-at-large Peter Robinson stops by to discuss a new book about the 1952 Western High Noon and reviews two movies from the UK. Stay with us. Leni Riefenstahl was the brilliant German film director of Triumph of the Will and Olympia, considered by some two of the greatest films ever directed by a woman, which also served as tremendous propaganda for Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. In Sarah Greenman's wildly creative multimedia play directed by John Tracy, Riefenstahl's older and younger selves edit a film of the director's life, playing out and reshooting scenes from her past until the director finds the beauty she is seeking. The actresses who play Leni in her various ages join me in studio today. Stacey Ross was last seen in Tom Stoppard's The Hard Problem at ACT. At Aurora, she has performed in such classics as Hedda Gabler and A Kind of Alaska, as well as the contemporary and cutting-edge Gideon's Knot. Welcome, Stacey.
Thanks.
And Martha Brigham, who was seen in the San Francisco Playhouse production of Stupid Effing Bird. Additional prominent roles with Marin Theater Company, Symmetry Theater, La Jolla Playhouse, among others, including the Aurora, where she appeared in The How and the Why. She graduated from the Lee Strasberg Theater and Film Institute and trained with L.A.'s comedy improv group, The Groundlings. Welcome to you, Martha.
Hey, thank you.
Well, let's talk about the conceit of the show here. How do you coordinate young and old Leni in the course of the play? Stacey.
Sarah, the playwright, starts with older Leni holding her own obituary and realizing that she can, that it's now time to do the final cut, as it were, of her life and make sure that the story she wants put out there is put out. And then younger Leni arrives to play those scenes. And the real conflict comes when they each decide, they seem to have different stories that they want to get out. And the younger Leni says to the older Leni, oh, I think you should help tell this story. And which puts each of them in very uncomfortable scenes. For younger Leni, it's scenes asking Hitler for money. For the older Leni, it's constantly being interrogated for anything from war profiteering to being a Nazi sympathizer, which was sort of the ultimate tag on her file, was sympathizer, which was actually fairly far down the list of what she could have been called or prosecuted as.
Mm. And are younger Leni and older Leni communicating with each other once they're both on stage?
Yes.
And so that's where some of the conflict comes in.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of conflict. It's also interesting for younger Leni to see herself at this point and learn along the way what has happened to her, because there is a script, and we use that a lot in the show. But she has to read through this and see where she's ended up. And I think that's where, you know, her doubt and her questions can come up a little bit more.
Hmm. Are you both making an effort to act or speak like each other, like the same person, the same character, or you're not so much concerned about that? Mannerisms perhaps the same, or
I think there are a couple mannerisms. It's not something that we, you know, we didn't play a bunch of mirror games or anything. We just sort of, ironically, people have been saying for months coming up to me, have you met Martha Brigham? She reminds me a lot of you.
Yeah.
And because we've known about this project since, well before the election, for months we've both been cast. I was like, well, it's funny you should say that. We're about to play the same character at different ages.
So has Trump asked you to make a film about him yet? I don't think we should go there.
I will say that one of my lines is the American media was lying, and I said so.
Yes.
So the Fuhrer told me that journalists were not to be trusted. So, yeah, and we do get an audible response.
We
from
do.
That.
I'm sure.
Even more so, actually, than the actual footage of Hitler. Because that's where we're at.
Right. And really, Hitler is so emblazoned on everyone's brain anyway. You go to any of the history channels, it's World War II this and World War II that. Mm.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to get a different perspective from someone that was considered the inner circle and that denied being close.
Yeah. I found it fascinating in skimming through a couple of the biographies. There's a dispassion when people write about Goering or Hitler or, you know, Speer wrote a bestseller. Nobody had a problem with that. You read the biographies of her, and there is real vitriol behind the author's voice in both the American one, which is considered definitive, about 8 years old, and one from Germany at the turn of this century. There's a hatred of her because she never capitulated. She never took responsibility. She never apologized.
Hmm.
And also, she.
Mm, yes.
I think that has a huge
exactly. Yeah. I mean, again, the parallels with contemporary standards, the way, you know, everyone took everything that Hillary said and just dissected it beyond belief.
Oh, yeah.
And there's something very, very powerful about that. Now, Leni was also a photographer. She was an actress, appeared in five very successful pictures. She was a dancer and a swimmer as well. Is any of that earlier part of her life taken in? Perhaps that's for the younger Leni.
Yes.
Martha Brigham.
Yes. Well,
I'm sorry, Stacey Ross.
Or Martha Brigham.
Yeah, Martha.
I know. See, you're already getting confused. This is how it works.
Happens all the time.
Happens all the time. Yeah, that we do bring up her dancing and how passionate she was. We've talked a lot about her movies before that and her acting and how strong and wild this woman was. She, I guess, she had no fears, which was wonderful to see that passion in somebody. And the Olympia and Triumph of the Will and these movies that she's made do appear in the play, and you can see this beautiful work that she's created, especially, and that's younger Leni, you know.
Mm-hmm. Stacey mentioned how she did some reading and research on Leni. Did you read her autobiography as well, or how did you prepare Martha?
I didn't read her. I mean, I read bits and parts of pretty much everything. But we would do a lot in rehearsal, the studies together. We would print out a lot of pieces of work that people had written about her obituary, which was really fascinating.
Sontag.
Susan Sontag, yeah. Which she wrote in the Times, and it's kind of brought up in the play itself. But it can be very sad, actually, to see the way they talk about this woman, because she is so historic in her films. You see Star Wars, you see Indiana Jones, you see these movies, and her ideas were pretty much brought into that, and yet she's known as pretty much one thing, one thing only.
Mm. Yeah. You mentioned the vitriol that was brought up, Stacey, about anyone that wrote about her and her life. I guess even back in 2000 when Jodie Foster was planning a biopic on Riefenstahl.
She got some pushback.
She got some pushback, yeah. Warned against a revisionist view of the director, and publicly stated that the critics stated that Riefenstahl seemed quite infatuated with Hitler and was a last surviving member of his inner circle. And it's hard to... She herself was very reticent about talking about that.
Yeah. I don't... It's one of those we'll never really know things, like, you know... And as fascinating as, you know, Lizzie Borden. Did she do it?
Hmm.
I do think she was close to him. But I also think we have different levels of friendship. And if you... I do think, although Sarah, our playwright, has created quite a lot. So much of it is, actually taken from fact and not a playwright inventing. But there's so, wow, I've really lost track of your question now.
Well, you earlier mentioned that she never really got the stigma erased from her. Is that addressed in the play about how she wanted to have a life after all this, and yet she was instantly associated for the rest of her life with this?
Yeah, that's...
How is that addressed in the play?
Oh, well, kind of given away the ending.
Yeah, I know, right?
Everyone dies in the end. Let's put it out
yes,
there, right?
Yes.
Well, yes.
Yeah, I think it's addressed throughout, but very strongly in a section of text that gets repeated, and I think she does know that her name will never be spoken aloud without it part of that sentence being Adolf Hitler, and I think ultimately that's crushing to her. She was never allowed to direct again. She's still considered one of, or the best female film director ever. So that's pretty amazing. I think if she had just said, wow, sorry, really shouldn't have done that, had no idea they were going to use my film, if she had just capitulated, she'd have gotten a 5-picture deal and it would have been fine.
She herself was never a member of the Nazi Party and yet found it difficult to overcome that association, which is the basis of the whole play.
Yeah.
Talking with Stacey Ross, who plays the older Leni Riefenstahl, side by side with Martha Brigham, who comes into the play as the younger Leni in the play Leni at the Aurora Theater. So what did you come away with your own opinions of Leni Riefenstahl after this whole experience? Well, Martha.
I have learned quite a bit about this woman, and I think that originally what you read is, you know, it's not positive. It's not positive feedback about Leni. But the more you dig and the more you learn about her, she's a genius. She's brilliant. And not only was she a movie director and created these absolutely wonderful films that were ahead of her time, she was, like you said, a dancer, a photographer. She's just an actress. She did one thing after the other. She's just a strong, passionate, independent woman. And there's something that I really respect in that, obviously. So all of the, you know, everything that she's dealt with, of course, if she had just fessed up to what she had done, it would have changed everything. But I don't judge her completely on that, you know. I've learned not to.
She's obviously this very strong character. Is any of her inner struggle or vulnerabilities portrayed in the play?
Yes, very much so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I won't give anything away.
All right. Stacey, how about you? What did you come away with as a final evaluation of Leni Riefenstahl?
There's a line in the play. She's in one of her 4 trials, I think, where she really goes off script and ends up with asks this question: can a single piece of art really be so dangerous? And I think I come away with yes, it can. It's a beautiful film. But you can see how used a certain way. She also says, you know, Hitler turned my film into a weapon, not me. You can see how something is used. And I think we see it all the time now, especially with the proliferation of screens everywhere, that a single piece of art can be so dangerous. But in that implies that it's powerful. So I have hope for that.
Well, what's John Tracy bringing to the equation as director?
John brings it all. Yep. He's the perfect director for this piece. He also did Gideon's Knot, which and Terminus, and he just, if anything, is knotty and gnarly and knotty as in Knotty, and just difficult. And where are they? And why are they saying this? John Tracy's the guy to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is this what they call a two-hander, or are there more cast members in all this? And I don't know why they call those two-handers. They're, you have two hands each, don't you? So shouldn't they be called four-handers?
This is true.
That's a good point.
I know.
Martha Brigham and Stacey Ross, starring as the cast of Lenny at the Aurora Theater. It's extended through the 7th of May. So try to catch it if you can. All the information is at auroratheater.org. Martha, Stacey, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Touch of the Music soundtrack from Olympia, the other great film that's Leni Riefenstahl's work in the background. Music from Leni Riefenstahl's film Olympia. Again, Leni at the Aurora Theater. Aurora Theater, that's theater with an R-E. AuroraTheater.org in Berkeley for more information. Well, continuing the innovative inaugural productions of the new, brand spanking newly renovated Curran Theater is eclipsed by Danai Gurira, who is star of AMC's The Walking Dead and directed by Liesl Tommy. Eclipsed made waves on Broadway as being the first cast, director, and playwright composed entirely of female artists, fitting for a production that so stunningly chronicles the experiences of a group of very resilient women. It's a story of five extraordinary women brought together by upheaval in their homeland of Liberia. They forge a close-knit community, one that inspires them to feats of increasingly greater strength. Joining me in the studio is Aisha Jordan, who plays the girl. Aisha is a New York City-based multidisciplinary performer and creator. Projects created and developed by Aisha include Enter and Exit, Family Reunion, and Playing House. In September of this past year, she presented a new work, Shasta Go Pop, at the Bushwick Star. Aisha, welcome to Open Air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Happy to have you here. Your character is the only one without a name, just the girl. Why is that?
Well, in the story, well, in the war, a lot of these women aren't able to say who they are. They're given, like in our story, though the wives have numbers. That's who they are, because, of course, if you are referred to as your name, you're still connected to home and who you are, and the whole point is to basically lose your identity, because if you don't have these connections, it's easier to control someone, I feel, when they're not connected to their history or their past.
Sure. So these five women are connected. What do they have in common? Let's talk about the story.
Well, other than war, I think that they are all, you know, daughters. Some have, you know, been mothers. One is about to be a mother. Many of them have experienced devastating loss, as well as violence and just seeing things that no human being should have to witness, you know, on almost a daily basis. Mm.
The play is set in a rebel camp during the second Liberian Civil War. What's going on there?
Well, in this camp that we're at, we stay in the CO compound. And, of course, the CO is the male character that we never actually see. But this is where the wives live, exist. You know, they take care of him. They're there when he calls upon us to be used and abused, you know, as needed. And also there to care for each other and protect each other to the best of our abilities.
Mm-hmm. What was your personal knowledge of these particular, maybe not particular Liberian women, but the situation in Liberia with regards to women in general before encountering Eclipsed? Did you know anything about the history?
Honestly, not a lot. I knew more about, for instance, like the war in Sierra Leone at the time. But for me, I came into my first production of Eclipsed in 2009 at the Woolly Mammoth Theater in D.C. And that was when I was really introduced to what was going on. And with all of the dramaturgy, and I mean, we had a huge binder full of pictures and images and stuff, which actually carried over into the Broadway performance. And so now, you know, I have two big vats of information.
Wow.
But yeah, so initially going in, I didn't know much. But once joining the project, that's when I started learning a lot more.
The director, Liesl Tommy, who directed the Broadway production as well, she reprises her role as director here at the Curran, the first woman of color to garner a Tony nomination for direction of a play.
Awesome.
And you worked with her in New York as well.
Yes.
So what was the preparation like?
Well, the preparation for me was a little different because I was the standby for the Broadway production. So I wasn't acting every single day or in rehearsal. We were, you know, observing, witnessing, watching. And then because I was a standby and I was going on once a week, we had rehearsals where I had to be prepared to go in and join the cast. So basically watching the show, you know, several times a week and
getting it ingrained,
getting it ingrained, and then just being able to hop in and ride.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
This production is first presented as a sold-out run at the Public Theater in New York and subsequently transferred to Broadway, as we mentioned, where it was nominated for 6 Tony Awards.
Yes.
Including one for Best Costume Design. So there must be something quite spectacular to be seeing on stage.
Clint Ramos, he really did something special with the costumes. I really feel like he captured the look and feel of what people were wearing and are wearing, you know. And the differences between the three women in the compound versus the other character, number 2, also known as Disgruntled, versus the peace woman, you know, we're all very different women. And the three in the compound look a little more similar, you know, up until Act 2 when my character makes a shift. And then, you know, Maima, she's very flashy, Disgruntled. She's got the hip-hop sort of gear. She's got the jeans and the earrings. And then the peace woman, Rita, who was a businesswoman. You know, she's very nice. She's very nicely dressed. She comes from a more educated, elite background. Yeah.
Tell us about your castmates, then.
Ah, my wonderful castmates. Hmm. I love them dearly. Stacey Sargent, she plays wife number 1. She's a New York native, and has a long history with this project. She's been in it since the workshops at the McCarter. And then there's Jonice Abbott-Pratt, who was part of the Broadway production. She plays wife number 3. Adeola Role plays wife number 2, a.k.a. Disgruntled, a.k.a. I already gave that away, Maima. And then Akusia Busia, who plays Rita, the peace woman, who was in the Broadway production as the same role. Yeah, just wonderful women.
Nice, nice. Yeah. And tell us about your family. Are they able? Did they see anything in New York? Are they coming here to see this San Francisco production?
Yes, my mother did see it in New York, and as well as she's on her way today to come see it here, which I'm really excited about.
Super.
I had some cousins coming. They came, on Sunday, and saw it because I have a lot of family in the West Coast, and in New York, I had quite a bit of family come to New York. My fiance came to New York, and he's here. So he's seen it. He's Eclipse's number one fan.
That must be kind of difficult for him to see, though, you on stage after what you go through as a character.
Yeah, it's an emotional journey, I think, to watch it. But, you know, you get through it. If these women in real life can handle it, I'm sure the viewers can as well.
Well, you really moved the Chronicle. The Chronicle Review mentioned Watch as the last captive wife, number four, also known as the girl, returns from being raped for the first time, communicating the horror of the act all the more forcefully in showing only its aftermath. Her vacant stare is that of a mortally wounded animal. She is being sapped of the spirit that had hitherto animated her.
Oh, wow. I haven't heard or read
that. That's some heavy stuff there.
Yeah.
Wow. This is playing through the 19th of the month at the Curran Theater. Beautiful theater.
It's a beautiful theater.
sfcurran.com is to find out some more information on that. The Curran will also continue, as it did in the Broadway production, an ongoing dedication after each performance to the still-missing schoolgirls of Chibok, northern Nigeria. Curran is also working to bring students in the Bay Area to see Eclipsed and take part in that dedication with specially priced student tickets. Tell us a little bit about the music that ends the whole play. We're going to have a clip of that.
Yes. The music that ends the play is a song that is actually sung by the cast. We recorded it, Broken Chord. They did the music they did the sound design for the show. And we recorded it with them back in New York. So we're all singing this lovely, lovely song.
Aisha Jordan, have a wonderful rest of the run.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Carol Shorenstein Hayes and Wally Hayes, for bringing us out here. You're wonderful.
Music from the play Eclipsed at the Curran Theater. My thanks to Aisha Jordan for coming and telling us about that. The play runs through the 19th of this month. Just a few more opportunities to catch it. Information about seeing it at the beautiful, newly renovated Curran Theater here in San Francisco, sfcurran.com. Peter Robinson will be by shortly to share some movie reviews, as well as some new information about an old classic. A touch of Inflammatus from Pergolesi's Stabat Mater. Together with David Taylor, my guest Hanneke van Proosde has co-founded and co-directs Voices of Music, celebrating its 10th anniversary with special concerts this weekend in conjunction with the San Francisco Early Music Society of Pergolesi's Stabat Mater. Bay Area performances Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Hanneke performs regularly with as soloist and continuous specialist with the Philharmonia Baroque, the Festspiel Orchestra Göttingen, as well as several other ensembles, including American Bach soloists, has recorded some 40 discs you can hear her on. She received her solo and teaching doctoral diplomas from the Royal Conservatory in The Hague in the Netherlands, where she studied recorder, harpsichord, and composition. She's co-founder of the Junior Recorder Society and was director of the SFEMS Medieval Renaissance Workshop for some 7 years, now directs, together with Rotem Gilbert, the SFEMS Recorder Workshop. Always a pleasure to welcome you back to our studios, Hanneke.
Thank you. It's very nice to be back here, David.
Well, 10 years. Congratulations on that front.
Yes, it's been a wonderful road. We never had imagined the travel, the journey that we've had when we started it.
Mm-hmm. So the Stabat Mater is part of this 10th anniversary celebration. How did you form and decide what to perform on this rather auspicious anniversary year?
Sure. Well, usually in our concert series, we program things that are some parts are well known and some parts are completely unknown. And so the people who come to our concerts like to be surprised hearing music that they don't know. For our special 10th anniversary, we decided not to do that. We decided to bring back some pieces that we've previously had and to celebrate and look back on the past 10 years.
I see you had a kind of a play on the three tenors this past January called The Three Cellos.
Indeed.
It was quite a concert. I'm sorry I missed that one.
Thank you.
Performing works of the Bach cello suites.
Indeed.
Some of the most amazing music ever written.
And our next project is indeed to record all six of the cello suites. And this is part of our digital library that we have online. We've been recording all our concerts. And over time, this has become a wonderful resource for people to use. We have, I think, 280 videos online, and we just reached 26 million viewers, online
viewers.
That's
extraordinary.
And some of these are being used in colleges and in high schools. We make sure that they're free for people to use so uh-huh. that they're easily accessible.
And that's all through voicesofmusic.org.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. So more about the Pergolesi Stabat Mater. We heard a touch of the Inflammatus from the 2012 recording.
Yes, that was also live from concert. It was with Dominique Labelle and Meg Bregel. This weekend we will have Meg Bregel back, which is wonderful. And we will also have Stephanie True appearing with our group for the first time. She's a Canadian soprano who lives in Europe, and it'll be very nice to have her appear.
And what, Hanneke, tell us a little bit more about Pergolesi and the Stabat Mater.
Pergolesi was a fantastic composer. He unfortunately died too soon. He was only 26 when he passed away. Fortunately for us, the Stabat Mater is an incredible piece of work. It was written in 1736, sacred work commissioned by the Confraternita del Cavalieri di San Luigi Palazzo in Naples, who before that had used the Stabat Mater by Alessandro Scarlatti year after year, and they felt they needed something new. And Pergolesi wrote this piece, and it instantly became famous throughout Europe for many, many years to come.
Mm. Only 26 when he passed away, and yet left such profound music, too.
He did.
Mm. And an opera of his that contains La Serva Padrona had quite a reception in Paris, I understand.
Indeed, it was the start of a riot between the opera buffa, the people who thought opera should be serious, and other people who thought opera should be fun.
Mm. We only heard two selected movements, we will have heard two selected movements from the Stabat Mater during this segment. How long is the work?
It's about 44 minutes long, and our 2012 performance is in its entirety online as well, if people want to have a preview.
At voicesofmusic.org. About how big is the ensemble?
We We like to have opportunities for one on a part as well as doubling, so that you have the concerto principle, concerto grosso principle, and we like to apply that for a lot of our Baroque music.
Mm-hmm. You're in three different venues. Do you have to adjust the performance technique depending on the venue you're at?
Of course. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, in our ensemble, we like to work with musicians who are not only very good musicians on their instruments, but who are also very good super listeners, we call them. We don't work as a conductor or with a conductor who directs what people should play. We do rehearse in rehearsals, of course, what we like to do with our phrasing and our music. But then live, on the stage, we like to invite the musicians to have each their own voice, meaning they can step forward. They have to listen to each other to go with that. And so each evening is actually very different from another evening.
Mm-hmm. What's being planned for season 11?
Ooh, we're getting there. We will have a big Renaissance project. We like to do medieval Renaissance and Baroque music, although most of our music is Baroque. We will have another concerto program, and we'll have a 17th century music program.
These performances of Pergolesi's Stabat Mater are Friday in Palo Alto, Saturday at St. Mark's Lutheran here in San Francisco, and on Sunday at St. Mary Magdalene in Berkeley. I understand this 10th anniversary is also bringing some accolades on a national level for your outreach efforts.
Indeed, we are very happy to be the recipients of the Early Music America, the Laurette Goldberg 2017 prize.
Very nice. So that's going to increase your efforts to expand even further?
Indeed. And we have several outreach programs, and of course the videos are part of that. We were also called by the San Francisco Classical Voice Best of the Bay for Early Music Concert last year, which was wonderful as well.
Very nice. Well, let's go out with some more of the wonderful music of Pergolesi, the Quando Corpus movement, so beautiful, as recorded in concert by your ensemble, Voices of Music, in 2012. In Quando Corpus is this movement. Performances, again, can be, and details about the rest of the season are at voicesofmusic.org, where you can also listen to and use as you choose literally hundreds of videos and recordings. Hanneke, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Music from the incredible Pergolese Stabat Mater. Here on Open Air, our weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. Information about those performances in the 10th anniversary season of Voices of Music at voicesofmusic.org. And now, as they say, for something completely different.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling, on this our wedding day. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. Wait long. I do not know what fate awaits me. I only know I must be brave, and I must face a man who hates me. A liar coward, a craven coward, a liar coward in my grave.
Great music of a different flavor for sure. That's Tex Ritter from the iconic film High Noon. And why are we having that on High 1 p.m. here on KLW? Well, to answer that question is the one and only Peter Robinson. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Yeah, good to be here. And just great, great lyrics. And the explanation behind it is a new book which has just come out by Glenn Frankel called High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. And this really is for movie buffs, I think for historians, for anybody who wants to revive a little bit about the history of the early 1950s, a great read. It brings everything together. High Noon, of course, was one of Hollywood's most iconic images, one man walking down a deserted western street towards a showdown with four armed killers. For more than 60 years, High Noon, starring Gary Cooper, has embedded itself in our culture and almost entrenched into our national memory. It was the favorite of many presidents from the time of Ike right through Bill Clinton and the Bushes. They all wanted to see at some point in their presidency the legendary High Noon. Now, this book is slightly different because it gives the bios of the different actors, including Gary Cooper. And, of course, it had the other three greats, Fred Zinnemann, Stanley Kramer, and the man who was blacklisted, Carl Foreman. So you see a movie which in itself is the story of a man turning to a town for support. He's deserted by them, and in the end, he has to take on the gunman by himself. And, of course, the little-known, unknown star, Grace Kelly, plays his wife. She is a Quaker, which adds another moment of doubt to whether killing is what it's all about. But the reason I highly recommend the book is that from historians' point of view, you realize what a hard time in the early 1950s as the House on Un-American Activities got underway, that being blacklisted not only put you out of a job, but it put you out of a job probably, as in Carl Foreman's case, almost for the rest of his life working in Hollywood. He had many successful movies which he made when he moved to London. And I think if you're interested in seeing the power not only of the Hollywood tycoons who all sided with the anti-communist position, but also the press. The press were very slow in defending people, and often, again, in the interest of preserving the status quo, did just that. They supported the investigations. So here's a book which brings history together, it brings politics together, it brings movie makings together, and I think it takes you behind the scenes. Highly recommended. The title one more time: High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic.
And chances are the film is available on Netflix or some other streaming service at this point. Great. classic film.
Yeah, and if you haven't seen it, that must be very few Americans who haven't. I discovered a small remarkable fact when I checked out the word High Noon on Google. I found that there are 8 gun shops between Anchorage and Florida who use the name. There's also a holster maker in Florida that uses it. And Fred Zinnemann, one of my favorite directors, I did meet him in the 60s in London, really explained it that he was interested in outsiders who take on a crisis, and a crisis of politics and a crisis of conscience. And when we look at some of his other films, for example, A Man for All Seasons, the story of Thomas More, again, you see a kind of repetition there. Gary Cooper, just one last word about him. He, of course, was a total anti-communist, but he did support the scriptwriter Carl Foreman. So you get an interesting dichotomy. And, of course, what you do get is what we opened with, the wonderful lyrics of "Do not forsake me, oh my darling, not until my wedding day."
The 1952 film won 4 Oscars.
Indeed it did. Now, we're still staying in the 1950s for 2 films which I think are very valuable in terms of asking the question, have we really emerged from what I call a post-racial society? And the first is set just after the war. It's set in 1947. It's set in London. And it's the story of an African prince from Bechuana land who falls in love with a British white secretary. And this, of course, raises all sorts of political issues in the early 1950s. Great acting by Rosamund Pike, who plays the secretary, and David Oyelowo, who plays the African prince. The title of the movie is United Kingdom. And I think out of this, the British government does not come out of it well at all. Clement Attlee is fearful that if the marriage, which goes through, means the prince returns to Africa, it will question the apartheid system which is existing in the country south to Bechuana land in South Africa. The tribes themselves are questioning whether they want a white queen. So there's many undercurrents going on in this, essentially a love story. And as I say, neither the Clement Attlee, who represented the Labour government, who backs away from being a supporter, to Winston Churchill, who actually is not depicted in the film, but in fact betrays the prince. So you have a love story meshed into the politics of England, of the Empire, of South Africa, and of course Bechuana in the mid-1950s. Now, when I say the story has a happy ending, I'm not giving anything away, because eventually, after studying law in England, the prince is eventually accepted back after they've been separated and has had to live in exile. But it raises those real questions. How accepting are we are today of interracial marriage, and what does a person's conscience play in separating people where clearly there's a love match? I highly recommend it. It's playing at many different cinemas here in the Bay Area. It's called United Kingdom, and I think it's a devastating little piece of history that not many people know about in terms of colonial powers operating and essentially dissecting and dividing the country. Today, Botswana is thriving and is certainly, if you're on a travel trip to Africa, a good place to visit. The name has changed from Bechuana land to what is known as today, which is indeed Botswana. Now, my second film has the very interesting and simple title, Get Out. And Get Out, I think, is the clue to understanding this movie. Again, a romance at the heart, where a white woman and a black lover suddenly face the issue, do her parents know that he is black? And whilst that may seem a simple question when you first say it, it immediately raises all sorts of questions about acceptance and understanding. Get Out is a slow burn in the first half as the story begins to evolve. And Chris, who is at the centre of the story, is taken to meet the parents, and he meets a bunch of white partygoers who are all on the outside liberals. However, it is set against the heading a horror film, and there are many moments where the classic horror devices begin to play out, but it's also a film about racism. Peele works well with actors, and Peele is, of course, the storyteller, the writer on this, and he brings together, I think, a question of what would you do in those circumstances? The film, I think, is to some extent a parody of how horror films get made. So you go through different moments in it. Some people say that he was influenced by Stepford Wives and by Rosemary's Baby, but Get Out really is a very different type of movie. And I think it's very relevant today when campaigns for Black Lives Matter has raised the same basic issue about the relationships within existing current 21st century societies. So there are two very different movies for different types of audiences, but addressing the theme in, I think, both contemporary and historical contexts. The first, United Kingdom, takes you back to the mid-1950s, and you raise questions about what the role of colonial powers are. And the second, Get Out, has got just a hint of guess who's coming to dinner. And Guess Who Comes to Dinner turns out to be a very subtle, understated, I think, a questioning of what do white liberals really mean when they talk about racism. I'd recommend them both for different reasons. One, to understand how things happen today, and also to understand how in the state of Bechuanaland, today's contemporary Botswana, things have come about and changed. And to go back to my original recommendation, just to give people a chance to follow the title, Glenn Frankel's book, it's called High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of American Classic. And that indeed asks another question, a different type of blacklist. This time, what happens if you lost your job because at some early point in your life you may have been a communist? A great week for moviegoers, a great week for movie buffs, and for people who like a history of the industry, High Noon by Glenn Frankel, a great recommendation.
Thanks, Peter, for all your recommendations. As usual, we'll look forward to your next dispatch, shall we say.
Good to be here. Thank you.
On this morning's Almanac, as I've been here since 05 a.m., I forgot to mention a very important birthday person, David Del Tredici. Born this date on March 16th, American composer, was winner of a Pulitzer Prize in music, a former Guggenheim and Woodrow Wilson fellow. He's considered a pioneer of the neo-romantic movement, described by the L.A. Times as one of our most flamboyant outsider composers. Del Tredici studied at the University of California, Berkeley, and he had a return visit here in San Francisco a few years back with the featured with the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, for which I had the great pleasure of playing flute to his piano. Let's hear, as a little birthday tribute, one of the most famous tunes that he penned from his opera Final Alice. Here is the acrostic song with Sarah Leonard, Fiona Clark, Nicola Jane Kemp, David Del Tredici, and the 16.
Yeah.
Happy birthday indeed to David Del Tredegy. This from his song cycle, not the opera. Maybe it will be an opera someday, David. We could only hope. Acrostic song. You heard Sarah Leonard, Fiona Clark, Nicola Jane Kemp, and David Del Tredegy, and 16, directed by Harry Christophers in Acrostic Song from Final Alice. More great music happening this weekend in addition to the Voices of Music and the theater that you heard about today. Program 3 of the New Century Chamber Orchestra presents Americans in Paris. The New Century Chamber Orchestra is joined by our very own Chanticleer. These performances are in Berkeley tonight at the First Presbyterian Church, tomorrow in Palo Alto at the, Palo Alto's performances at the Oshman Family Jewish Community Center, and Saturday here in San Francisco at the Herbst, and then Sunday in San Rafael at the Osher Marin Jewish Community Center. Information about their concert at at cityboxoffice.com for tickets and information on that one. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air, our weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. If you've got a segment you'd like featured or some folks that you feel deserve a little radio time in here in the Bay Area when they're coming through town or locally, by all means, send me an email, david@kalw.org. The show is produced by Neil Swinkles. Our shows are archived at our website, kalw.org. Thanks for listening.